Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to the show. This week we're talking about the emotional and mental state of Charlie Sheen and if he really could be experiencing bipolar disorder. We speak with Dr. Randy Mazenter, a clinical psychologist who not only explains what being bipolar is, but what symptoms you can experience. We also touch on a very serious story involving the U.S. military and an outrageous religious group, the Westboro Baptist Church, who targets soldiers' funerals by protesting with very degrading and insensitive signs. We got a lot to do. Let's go.
Capture your need for sound.
In the last couple of months, actor Charlie Sheen has continued to spiral out of control. He's gone from a respected actor to a man who seems out of control and out of touch with reality. In a very short time, he's been fired from his high-profile gig on Two and a Half Men, and he's alienated many of his family, friends, and even his fans with his vengeful, bizarre, and sometimes erratic behavior. To help give us some insight as to what may be going on, please welcome back to the show Dr. Randy Mazenter, a clinical psychologist on staff at Barnes Jewish Hospital and Washington University Medical School in St. Louis, Missouri. Dr. Mazenter, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Kelly, so much. Always a pleasure.
Dr. Mazenter, I almost don't even know where to start because as each day passes, Charlie Sheen seems further and further out of touch with reality. From the footage you've seen, can you tell us what you think might be going on and has these years of drug use finally caught up with him?
I mean, I think that's a very good question. I think that's the question on everyone's mind. The first time I saw one of these recent clips with him ranting and raving and, you know, calling himself godlike and talking very quickly, I have to admit the first thing that crossed my mind was, is this guy in the midst of a manic episode? Since that time, I have heard a lot of people bandy about, gee, is he bipolar? And even during one of his episodes, him kind of ranting and raving and saying, I can't believe people have called me bipolar, of course, that's not what's going on. So let's talk about that for one second. A bipolar episode or a bipolar disorder, a bipolar illness, is what used to be called in a previous diagnostic manual days, manic depression, which is a term that more people are familiar with. To get the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, and there's different sorts, you only have to have one manic episode at any time in your life. You don't ever have to have a depressed episode, which most people don't know. So to get the diagnosis, you just have to meet criteria for one manic episode, okay?
Wow.
Here's the tricky part. A manic episode has to be a distinct period of abnormally and persistently elevated, expansive, or irritable mood lasting at least a week. Or less if you have to be in the hospital, if it's that bad. But here's the thing. It has to be different than the person's normal level of functioning. Well, clearly, a lot of people have always seen him as a drug abuser and kind of an on-the-edge kind of guy, but he's never gotten himself in this kind of trouble. So it seems like something's going on. The other thing is, if the person's on drugs or the symptoms are caused by drugs, then, of course, you don't get the bipolar diagnosis because it's due to drugs. So that's one of the questions that we have no way of knowing, although apparently he's been drug tested recently and he's clean. So people are saying, well, you know, could this be the impact of all these drugs over a long period of time? Well, it's possible. It's possible. But it's kind of suspicious if he's not on any drugs at this time. You have to wonder, well, you know, if he's not really under the influence, if he really has been clean and sober, at least from drugs, as he's been saying for the last month, either his brain is markedly different than it was before, or, you know, something else is going on. But listen to the symptoms of bipolar disorder, a manic episode. So you've got that distinct period that's different than normal, okay, and it lasts a week. Here's the thing. During this period of time, you only need three or more of these symptoms to qualify for the diagnosis. So it's very cut and dry. Either you meet the criteria and you have this stuff, or you don't. That's how the diagnosis is made. So it's not kind of touchy-feely or maybe this or maybe that. It's kind of, does the person have these things or not? And again, you only need three. You ready?
Yeah.
Inflated self-esteem or grandiosity? Well,
wow.
There's no question about that. He's ranting and raving about how he's the Messiah, how he's so wonderful, about the drug he's on is a Charlie Sheen drug and all this other stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we know he has that. Decreased need for sleep, in other words, feeling rested after about 3 hours of sleep. We don't know. Maybe. You know, I don't know if he's talked about that. That's, you know, a little more subjective from what we know. More talkative than usual or pressure to keep talking.
Wow.
Kind of looks that way. I'm sure his publicist who quit and everyone else is saying, you know, Charlie, keep your mouth shut, please. You're getting yourself in more trouble. Flight of ideas or subjective experience that thoughts are racing. So jumping from one thing to another, kind of talking out of his head. You know, that's what we're seeing, and that's what people really seem to be reacting to. Distractibility, in other words, you know, his attention span is jumping all over the place. His attention's easily drawn to unimportant or irrelevant external things. So, you know, is he talking and then all of a sudden focusing on something across the room or something that happened that's kind of not in the flow of thought of what he's talking about? Increase in goal-directed activity. So that could be socially, at work, school, or sexually, or psychomotor agitation. Well, he certainly looks agitated, hyper. And it seems that his sexual escapades may be increasing in terms of living with these women and talking about, you know, how everybody wants him and interviewing now for another woman to move in. Kind of looks that way. And again, is it different than his normal? It seems that way.
Wow.
You know, he's you know, getting himself in a lot of trouble, and he wasn't doing that before. You know, he may have been doing some of these things. He may have had this kind of, you know, flagrant personality, but something's clearly at least quantitatively different. There's more, 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 but maybe qualitatively different too. And the last symptom is, you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
This is the best. Excessive involvement in pleasurable activities that have a high potential for painful consequences, like engaging in unrestrained buying sprees, sexual indiscretions, foolish business investments. I mean, that's what he's doing. He's blowing up his career.
Wow.
So do we think he has three of those seven things?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sure sounds like that. And again, it has to be sufficiently severe to cause marked impairment in work functioning, relationships, social activities. Well, yeah. But again, it can't be due to the direct effect of substance abuse.
Wow.
Well, I got all that out. See, now I sound all revved up.
It's so shocking. Like, it's so, and then I guess, you know, I have a bunch of questions, you know, stemming from what you've just said. But so the first thing to clarify is, you know, he does have X amount of those symptoms, you know, so it's looking like he has a bipolar disorder.
It sure seems to.
Okay. And that is not from the drugs. That is just from his own personality, or it could be from the drugs.
I mean, we don't know.
Okay.
See, that's the thing. If he's generally, when you, and again, you can't make a diagnosis unless you do a proper evaluation, you do a good history, you do an appropriate evaluation. So is it, you know, appropriate or fair to say, oh, he's this, based on what I see on these interviews? Of course not. You know, that's kind of armchair speculation.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, this is the criteria. This is how the diagnosis is made. And so if you see all these things that are really suggestive, you know, you really want to get the person in for an evaluation. And usually when someone is having a manic episode, their friends and family are screaming and yelling, this person is acting crazy. Something's not right. They're ranting and raving. They're all agitated and revved up all the time. They're thinking that they're, you know, a godlike entity. You know, what's going on? Because it's so over the top. And that oftentimes is the classic presentation of somebody having a manic or bipolar manic episode.
And a question for you, something that I've noticed, you know, as you and I have discussed before, obviously I work in radio and do a lot of, you know, my life revolves sort of around the entertainment industry. So as you can imagine, I've seen Charlie interviewed on several occasions prior to these last couple of months. And when I saw, I guess, the first or one of the first times where he was ranting and raving, you know, a week or so ago, I hadn't seen him before like that. And it actually scared me because I've never seen him like that. Like when you would look into his eyes, and for lack of a better word, it looked like he had tweaked. And and I don't even know the man, but like I said, I've seen him enough in prior interviews to know when he was sort of relaxed and sort of present. And he looks like some sort of scared and agitated animal.
Or somebody that's under the influence of some, you know, meth or some really agitating illegal drug.
Mm-hmm. And then my question is, how can he go from that? Because like, you know, we've seen several instances of him being super agitated in these interviews. But then, for example, you know, I remember a night after seeing him be severely, you know, crazy, for lack of a better word, he then appeared on the Piers Morgan show, very calm and relaxed. And he still seemed, you know, some of his diatribe was still out there, but it was a marked difference from 24 hours prior. So how can he go back and forth from this agitation to seemingly calm?
Well, a couple of things. One is we don't know what he's taking, if anything.
Okay.
So, you know, might he be, you know, ingesting something legal or illegal to try to calm him down, get him under control? I mean, I would think that, you know, he's got physicians on staff and they're saying, you know, come on, you're blowing up your career. You've got to go on this show and appear, you know, a little more stable and contrite, apologetic. Come on. And so, you know, what are they doing to help him with that? We don't know that. The other thing is that, you know, in the midst of a full-blown high-level manic episode, the person really has no control or very little. But that doesn't mean it looks exactly the same every minute of the day. There are a lot of it. There are, you know, some variability. The other thing, though, is that people can have hypomanic episodes, which are not quite as severe, not quite as extreme in their symptoms, or less long-acting, and might they have a little more control from, you know, time to time? Well, they might.
Okay.
One of my favorite stories, and I'll make it really brief, but it's a great story. I was working in a city-state mental institution where the people were very, very severely ill, had been there for a very, very long time, and I was watching a gentleman sitting in the day room watching TV who was very psychotic. He was talking to himself. He was ranting and raving. He was making no sense at all. He was what, you know, the layperson would call, you know, totally out of it. And this elderly woman came in. She was another patient, and she was also totally out of it. And she starts screaming and yelling at him, saying, "You're a bad son. I can't believe you never come and see me." And she was tiny. He was huge. And she's like pushing at him. Well, the staff all stands up because they're just waiting for some horrible outcome. And I'll never forget, because I could see the look in his eyes. He looked at her. His eyes cleared. He was totally aware at that moment. And he looked at her with compassion and he said, "I'm really sorry, Mom. I'll do better."
Wow.
Clearly, something that she was doing or saying got through to him. And in that moment, it looked like he understood what was going on. He felt so sorry and so compassionate for her. He was able to kind of clear his own functioning for that moment. And then 2 minutes later, you know, she was happy. They hugged. She left. And he went back to his previous state. What was that? I always remember that, because I think when we think about mental illness or we think about really severe episodes, we think that they're always exactly the same, without any insight, without any ability to control, without any knowledge of anything that's going on. And it certainly can be that, but I think it's much more variable than that, and that people sometimes can go from a very extreme state to brief points of better understanding.
Joining us on the show from St. Louis, Missouri, is clinical psychologist Dr. Randy Mazenter. Dr. Mazenter, can Charlie Sheen, you know, come out of this tailspin, or is he headed for some sort of disaster like suicide, or, you know what I mean? Because I just think no one knows where he's headed with this.
I mean, I think it really depends on what's going on. If this really is, if he does have bipolar disorder, if this is a manic episode and he gets proper medical attention, I mean, treatment is really effective. So if that's what's going on and he gets the appropriate treatment, would I expect for his symptoms to resolve themselves? Yeah. There are a lot of people that live with bipolar disorder. They do extremely well. They're high functioning. They're quote, normal.
Okay.
Because they take the medications that control the brain chemistry.
Okay. And when,
if, you know,
sorry, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, you know, if he's really using all kinds of drugs that we don't know about, you know, that's a different story. If, you know, somehow the drugs that he's exposed his brain to have caused brain damage, and that this is the result of, you know, some physiological process that has caused some permanent type damage, that may be different, but we don't know. The real question is, will he get proper treatment? And, you know, if this is a bipolar disorder, will he become severely depressed?
And, you know, in the state that he's in now, I don't think he's listening to anyone. And then the people that are around him are definitely hangers-on. And just, mm-hmm. You know, you can see it. You can see that they're just in it for whatever they can get out of this. So I don't feel that he has a team around him right now that can actually get through to him. And I feel bad for his family, because I think they want to help. I believe his father, Martin Sheen, has tried to reach out to him, and that didn't work. Will he have to be forcibly, like, institutionalized, or can he just run rampant till he actually just crashes?
I mean, it depends. Really, you can't forcibly lock someone up unless you can prove that they're a danger to themselves or someone else. And the laws are different in different countries, and they're different in different states. And so, you know, what kind of symptoms they have to exhibit, usually, again, it's danger to self or others. You know, and usually what you're talking about is killing themselves, you know, being a risk to yourself or someone else in terms of bodily harm. You may be able, depending on the state laws, to hold somebody for up to 72 hours against their will in order to have time to prepare your court case. But, you know, the fact that no one can get to him in terms of he's not listening, oftentimes that's really a symptom of a manic episode. There's no insight. There's no understanding. There's no, these people can be really happy and really resistant to treatment because it feels good.
And, you know, much has been made about his children. His two sons mm-hmm. were taken from the home. Is it dangerous for his children to be near him right now?
Well, I think it really depends on his symptoms. I mean, what's he doing? You know, how's his judgment? His judgment doesn't look really very good, and perhaps that's what they're worried about. Not will he actively try and harm them, but is his judgment so bad that he can't be a responsible guardian?
And what do you say to his family and friends right now, like his dad, you know, Martin Sheen? Is there anything that they can do, or is it best for them to sort of stay away from this mess?
I mean, I think if you just stay away from it, that's really of no help. You know, it's really frustrating and aggravating to try and convince somebody to do something that they don't want to do, even though you think it's for their best good. But, you know, I think you have to try.
Okay. And if you were...
So what's going to happen? They're going to get angry with you. They're going to yell at you. They're going to call you names. They're going to resist you. They're going to resent you. Okay. So what? You know, how are you going to feel if you just say, well, they're not going to listen to me, and so there's nothing I can do? Again, if people are really ill, it's not that they're not listening to you. It's they're not capable of it, perhaps. So what are you willing to do to try to continue to have some positive impact?
And just a final question, Dr. Mazenter, if you were in charge of this case in dealing with Charlie, what would you like to see happen in the next, you know, week? Like if all things were being fair and we could actually do something, where would you like to see, you know, him headed in the next week or so?
I'd like to see him have an appropriate evaluation by, you know, a competent mental health practitioner.
Well, I know I think all of us wish him the best of luck. And thank you so much, Dr. Mazenter, for joining us today on the show. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Kelly. Anytime.
That's Dr. Randy Mazenter, a clinical psychologist on staff at Barnes Jewish Hospital and Washington University Medical School in St. Louis, Missouri, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
As I'm sure you figured out by now, I am a huge fan of Janet Jackson. We've talked about it on the show before, and recently I had the great fortune to head to Toronto to see Janet perform in her current up close and personal tour. And there is a difference on this particular tour. She's not doing the big arenas that she normally does. It really is up close and personal. She's going to theaters this time around with seats of anywhere between 3,000 to 5,000 seats. And the reason she's doing this is she says that she really wants to be intimate with her fans. She wants to, be up close, like she says in the tour title. And she even calls it a love affair between herself and the fans. She wants to give back for all the love that we've given her for the past couple of decades. So the show itself is fantastic. The other thing that she's sort of focusing on is her 35 number one hits. So when you go to see this performance, she's not doing new tracks or stuff like that. It's all songs that have reached number one. She does have a recent one that came out last year that hit number one on the dance charts, Make Me. So that is one that she's doing, but there's no sort of album cuts. It's all number one songs. So if you are a fan of Janet, whether it's vintage from the 80s, the Control era, Rhythm Nation, the Janet album, the All For You from 2001, she goes through them all. And I have to say, she was just on fire. Her band was amazing, and the dancers were fierce as usual, and Janet has not lost a step keeping time, you know, with her dancers when she's on the stage. And you know, one of the things that I actually noticed this time around with this tour is that Janet actually seems to be having fun. Now, it's not to say that she didn't have fun on the other tours. I've seen her many times before on the Velvet Rope tour, on the All For You tour, as well as the Janet tour. But this time, I don't know if it's because she's been away from the stage for a little while that she's taking more time to enjoy it. I'm not quite sure what it is, but you can just tell on stage that she's having such a great time, having fun with her band, with the dancers, and definitely interacting with us, her fans. So an amazing, amazing show. If it comes to your town, your city, I definitely suggest that you go see it. And if for nothing else, to see her little tribute that she does to her brother Michael. She actually sings their hit song Scream. So she has him up on the video screen doing his sort of portion of the song, and then she kicks in with her verses, and everybody went crazy. That was the song that got the most response out of the whole night. And then at the end of the show, one of her final songs that she does is Together Again. And if you are a fan of Janet, you know that Together Again is a song that she wrote back in the late 90s in her 97 album, The Velvet Rope, where it was written for friends of hers who had passed away from AIDS. And it's sort of become this anthem for all of her fans, for people that, you know, we've lost in our lives. And it's sort of this way of saying that we'll see you and we'll eventually be together again. And so she finished the show pretty much with this song. And she actually did a little tribute to Michael with pictures of him up on the screen. And I have to say, I think a lot of us got teary eyed because it was just so touching. And you could see that she was happy to do that, to sort of share that moment, you know, between herself and her brother and share it with the fans. So just a fantastic show. And, you know, in case you haven't heard the song in a while, I thought we would play Together Again because, you know, it was a number one hit for Janet in the late 90s, and it continues to make people smile today. So here is Janet Jackson, Together Again, on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Get you.
the past 20 years, the congregation of the Westboro Baptist Church has picketed military funerals to communicate its belief that God hates the United States for its tolerance of homosexuality, particularly in America's military. Now, in 2006, Fred Phelps, who founded the church, and six Westboro Baptist parishioners traveled to Maryland to picket the funeral of Marine Lance Corporal Matthew Snyder, who was killed in Iraq in the line of duty. Now, as you can imagine, this scene caused a lot of pain for Matthew's family and friends, and they subsequently took the Westboro Baptist Church to court. Now, it's been quite the wild ride over these last almost 5 years, with the Supreme Court recently reaching its decision on the case. To give us an inside look as to what's gone on with this case is Professor Steve Heyman of Chicago Kent College of Law, a graduate of Harvard Law School, and who helped consult on the case for Matthew's family. Steve, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
Steve, first of all, in layman's terms, on what grounds did Matthew's family sue Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church? And after more than 4 years of litigation, what was the ruling of the Supreme Court?
Matthew's family sued the church alleging that the church had invaded their privacy by interfering with their ability to bury Matthew in peace, and that they had also committed a tort called intentional infliction of emotional distress. That is, intentionally inflicting severe emotional distress on them in a way that's utterly outrageous and intolerable in a civilized society. And the Snyder family actually won at the trial court, and the jury awarded them $5 million in damages. But when the case went up on appeal and when it reached the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court just last week ruled 8-1 in favor of the protesters. And basically what Chief Justice Roberts said in the case is he said our opinion is very narrow. It is focusing only on the particular facts of this case. And as he read the record, the protesters were standing about 1,000 feet away from the funeral. He said that nobody who was at the funeral saw or heard them, that they didn't directly interfere with funeral service itself. And although Matthew's father came within 200 or 300 feet during the funeral procession of where the picketers were standing, all he saw were the tops of the signs. He didn't actually see what was written on them. So Robert said that the picketers did not actually interfere with the funeral, and that, on the other hand, that no matter how controversial their speech was, that they were addressing matters of public concern. For example, the United States' tolerance of homosexuality. And he said that a jury shouldn't be allowed to find that somebody's speech is so outrageous that they should be subjected to millions of dollars in damages. So that was the basis of the decision.
Now, I should sort of put out there, and I don't even want to do this, but I should put out there for people who haven't followed the case or followed this Westboro Baptist Church. From what I understand, they've picketed at least 600 funerals, I think, in the last, you know, however many years. And I just want to put out some of the signs that they have had at these funerals, because I want people to understand, you know, why this is so upsetting. It's not just, you know, these little signs that don't matter. It's very hateful speech. And for example, some of the signs read, "Thank God for dead soldiers," "God hates fags," "You're going to hell," and "God hates you." And I know you said that apparently Mr. Snyder, the father, did not see the actual signs during the day of the funeral, but then later on, I believe he saw televised footage of it.
That's right. And of course, he knew what was coming even before it happened. What Westboro does is when they see a funeral notice in a newspaper, they issue a press release saying, "We're going to come and picket this funeral." The Snyder family knew this ahead of time, and one of the arguments that the family was making is that even just by announcing that they were going to come and descend on this little town in Maryland with these very hateful signs, that was enough to poison the whole atmosphere surrounding the funeral and to turn the whole thing into a bit of a circus. There were public safety vehicles of all kinds surrounding the place. The funeral procession had to be rerouted in order to avoid the protesters. The court said that the protesters were standing 1,000 feet away, and that's one way to look at it. But another way to look at it is that they were standing right at the parking lot of the church, and that the whole procession had to be rerouted to not encounter them. So from the Snyder's family point of view, even though it's true that they didn't actually see the protest when it was going on, or they couldn't read the signs, nevertheless, they felt like they took the full emotional brunt of this very hateful message.
And, you know, I'm not even going to hide my disdain for what went on, because I just think it's awful. And a question I would have, though, Steve, is and I get, I don't know if it comes down to semantics, because I know from what I read from the information that you sent me with regards to the ruling that, you know, the Westboro Baptist Church did follow, I guess, civil protocol, where they kept those, you know, 1,000 feet distance and were on like public property. And so they basically hid behind that. But then where does the argument go with the fact, like you just mentioned a few moments ago, that yes, they followed those specific rules, but the tone and the shadow that they cast over the public that was going to be attending this funeral, as well as the family, it did invoke distress. So how did the Supreme Court, was that just disregarded in the argument? Like, they were able to just disregard that when it came down to the ruling?
I'm afraid so. And that's the problem that I have with the ruling as well. It is true that that the Chief Justice emphasized how narrow the ruling was and emphasized the facts that I mentioned about how far away that they were standing. But at the same time, he acknowledged that this protest had added to the already incalculable grief that the Snyder family had experienced. And his response to that was that that we still need to protect even very hurtful, very painful speech in order to protect the value of public debate. And I guess my reaction to that is that in many cases, it would make sense to say that. You shouldn't be able to shut off debate simply because you're upset about the ideas that other people are expressing. But this is something else. This was a situation where the protesters were using speech as a weapon against this family at a time of unbelievable emotional distress and vulnerability. And that was the point that Justice Alito made in dissent. He said, I don't think we would lose anything from the standpoint of vigorous public debate if we simply said that funerals are off limits.
I think that's amazing, because I did read a bunch of what he said in his dissent, and I agreed with a lot of it. And I guess that's why I was dismayed, to say the least, about the ruling. And I guess a couple of questions based off that. First of all, I guess overall, in the end, this case boiled down to freedom of speech. That's my first question for you. And then I guess the second part of that, now that they've made their ruling, I suppose the Snyder family has no recourse. Like, it's done. The decision is made.
Yes, that's right. From the Snyder family's point of view, it is done. And there isn't anything else that they can do. But I think that there's a sense in which the Snyder family feels that they, not only that they felt that they were justified in fighting to protect military families and other families from this kind of an assault, but that also that in a significant sense they won an important victory here as well. And this is something that hasn't been reported so much. It is true that the Supreme Court said that the protesters couldn't be made to pay millions of dollars in damages here. But at the same time, the Supreme Court said that they thought that it was perfectly reasonable for states or for Congress to pass what are called buffer zone laws that require the protesters to stand a certain distance away. And that was an issue that was very unclear and unsettled in American law before the Snyder decision. And now that they have decided it, or now that the court has said this, it suggests that that states really do have the ability to protect families, at least against the protesters being right up in their face. Although, you know, as I said, simply the fact that the protesters announce that they're coming can be enough to be distressing to the family.
I just think it's atrocious, actually. And a question for you, too, Steve, off of that. How has the Snyder family reacted? Because I know, like you've just mentioned, that they have, in a way, won a bit of the victory because, like, maybe these changes can come through. But in the end, with the family itself, what was their reaction and how are they dealing with this ruling?
I haven't been in touch with them myself, but I saw some of Al Snyder, the father's, appearances on television, and you could tell that he was very shaken and disturbed by the court's decision. And his basic reaction was that while a decision like this may reflect a lot of book learning or sort of abstract intellectual reasoning, that he thought it was a decision that was devoid of common sense. And to that extent, I think he may be right. American society, like many other societies, is divided by very fundamental disagreements. But it seems to me that if we agree on anything, the left and the right, we agree that you just don't go to somebody's funeral and celebrate their violent death and declare that they're going to hell.
Joining us on the show is law professor Steve Haven of Chicago Kent College of Law. Steve, you know, a question that I would have as well now with this Supreme Court ruling, and I know you mentioned earlier that it was specific to this case, but does their ruling on this specific case open the floodgates for other, you know, zealots, I guess would be my term for them, to start, you know, protesting around the states and causing, you know, pain and anguish like this particular group has done?
Well, I'm afraid that it might, Kelly. The Westboro Church itself has, of course, they're gloating about this victory, and they announced that they were going to quadruple the number of protests that they themselves were planning to do around the country. That's probably kind of tall talk because it's a tiny little group, and I'm not sure they have the capacity to quadruple what they've been doing. But I think you're right. There's a real danger that this is going to encourage other zealots to engage in this kind of activity. I saw a video the other day of an anti-Muslim protest in California that was just frightening in its intensity and the degree of hatred that was being directed against the group. And I do think that a decision like the Snyder case may embolden groups like that.
That's just awful, awful. And I cannot help but feel so bad, you know, for the Snyder family and other families that have had to go through this. And, you know, you just mentioned that this has sort of lit a fire under this Westboro church to continue their efforts. And I'm assuming they will continue to hide under, I guess, civil ordinances, if possible, to continue what they're doing. But can anything be done to sort of stop Fred Phelps and his Westboro church? Or is he off to the races now, hiding behind freedom of speech?
I think he's pretty much off to the races, but I do think that the passage in the Supreme Court's opinion that said that it was permissible for states to enact these buffer zone laws and to keep the protesters a distance away from the funerals, it wouldn't surprise me if a number of states either pass or strengthen the laws that they already have. 44 of our 50 states already do have buffer zone laws. But some of them are pretty minimal. There was no law in Maryland at the time that the Snyder protest happened, but afterwards they had passed a law that required a 100-foot buffer zone, and that doesn't provide a lot of protection. It wouldn't surprise me if there are a number of laws that are passed that try to push the protesters further back.
And something else that popped into my mind as you were speaking, which brings me back to the Snyder family itself. You were consulting with their lawyer to try to help them through this with regards to their case that they put forth. Because again, I don't think many of us know the sort of inner workings of the case itself. What were the main points that the Snyder family was trying to get across, even though in the end it didn't work out?
I think that the main points that the family was trying to get across is the notion of just how very hurtful this speech was and how it was really unnecessary from the standpoint of public debate. So the argument was that the Westboro church has the ability to promote their views in any of a number of ways, through the internet, through publications, through speeches in public parks or in the public square. So there are literally countless different ways that they could make their arguments, and that it wasn't necessary to brutalize one particular family when they're trying to bury their son. That was the main point that we were trying to make. And I think that the justices were sympathetic. I don't think the decision should be read to say that there's just no problem with people coming and inflicting this kind of pain on others. But I think that the justices, they were afraid of opening the floodgates in another direction and maybe undermining the freedom of speech for other unpopular groups that might be more legitimately trying to actually express their views in a way that was less intrusive than what the Westboro protesters were doing. In some ways, the whole issue comes down to, can you draw a line around funerals and say that that's an exception to the general rules about free speech or not? And we really thought that would make sense. And Justice Alito thought that in his dissenting opinion. But the majority of the justices, I think they weren't comfortable with drawing that line. And instead, what they thought is that the best way to reconcile the competing values at stake in a case like this is to have these buffer zone laws that don't simply allow a jury to punish a speaker if they find the speech itself outrageous.
And Steve, were you surprised with the way the ruling came down? Because I know you mentioned earlier that it was sort of 8-1 with Justice Alito being the only one that was dissenting. Did you think it would come down like that, or did you think it would be more split?
I was a little surprised and of course disappointed. I went to Washington the first week of October to watch the oral argument, and that was an amazing experience. The courtroom was packed, and it was filled with people from the Westboro Church, from the military community, there wasn't a single seat that was there in the courtroom. And the justices were completely on top of the facts and the arguments in the case, and they really raked both sides over the coals. They asked very tough questions to the lawyers for both sides. My own sense was that there might have been five or six justices who might have been open to ruling for the Snyder family here. So I had thought that it was possible the case would come out that way. And I think everybody thought that it was going to be a much closer vote than what it actually was. But, you know, Kelly, the very fact that it was so overwhelming, that it was an 8-1 vote, suggests that we probably shouldn't read too much into the decision, because I think what the justices thought is that that in this situation, the protest was just too far away to really allow a big damages award like this. But they did say in a lot of ways that if the facts had been different, then it would have raised different issues than it did.
And if I sort of ask you for a moment to take off your objective hat, because I know you've been in the law field for many years, what does this ruling mean to you? Because I know, earlier you mentioned that I think the Supreme Court was looking at it as a specific case and a specific set of circumstances. But I think it does reach more than that. I think it is far reaching to many people, and it does have a bit more overtones than just these specific cases, because yes. I think human beings I'm not even involved in this. I'm a Canadian, and I am so upset about this church and what they've been doing. So I have to ask you, as a human being, as a U.S. citizen, and I guess maybe if you can sort of speak for some of your other, citizens, what do you think the tone is now in the country with regards to this ruling?
I think that there's a lot of public outrage and astonishment at a decision like this. And you're right, and the public generally it's not aware of the intricacies of a particular case like this, but the Supreme Court should understand that its role is not just to decide a particular case, but to be an educator and to sort of teach the country about what the meaning of our Constitution is and the meaning of our basic values. And in that way, I think the court really blew it here, because the message that they sent, whether or not they intended to, was a message that it doesn't matter how hateful or cruel or emotionally disturbing your speech is, that we protect it all the more for it. And so I have to say that my own personal reaction is to be a little heartbroken about a decision like this. My sense is that the reason why we have such a commitment and a belief in freedom of speech is that we believe that this is a way of respecting human dignity, that to shut people up and prevent them from being able to express their views would be inconsistent with the respect that we owe to one another as members of a community. But the kind of speech that the Westboro people were engaged in here itself was the deepest denial of the human dignity of the Snyder family and of Matt Snyder himself, who laid down his life for his country. And if there's ever a time in our social life when we should be able to respect the value of human life and the value of other members of the community, it should be in a funeral. So to my mind, allowing the protesters to really desecrate a funeral and to intrude in the way in which they did, to celebrate the violent death of this soldier, is really just goes against everything that our Constitution should be about.
I really appreciate that viewpoint, Steve, because I think, you know, when you step away from the law books for a second, if we all just take a step back, and I think what maybe Mr. Snyder was trying to get through, you know, to the courts and to even maybe Fred Phelps and his followers as well, is like, this is my son. He has passed away doing his duty for the country, and I would like to remember his funeral in a positive light as best as possible. And now you have totally taken that from me, and I have a horrible bad taste in my mouth for the rest of my life with regards to that. So I appreciate that you sort of, you know, took it to that level and let us see that. So thank you so much for that, Steve. And I really appreciate your time on the show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for having me.
That's law professor Steve Heyman of Chicago Kent College of Law, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Bring on the remix.
Oh yeah. Ooh, when love awaits her, my heart is
That's Alex Godino featuring Kelly Rowland with What a Feeling on The Kelly Alexander Show. We also heard from Janet Jackson with Together Again from her very successful album from 1997, The Velvet Rope. Well, there you go. Another show is come and gone. Thank you so much to my guests, Dr. Randy Mazenter and Steve Heyman out of Chicago. And you know what? Please stay tuned for next week because we have a fantastic show featuring a very special guest, Doris Gallen. She's the author of The Boomer's Guide to Going Abroad to Travel, Live, Give, and Learn. Now, here's the deal. Doris and her husband actually got tired of working and sort of doing that whole corporate lifestyle. So they sold off all of their possessions and took off traveling for the past 5 years, visiting 50 countries. And she has an amazing story to tell, and I can't wait for you to hear it. That is next week on the show. If you have any comments or questions, don't hesitate to drop me a line, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. Have a fantastic week. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.